In the selections from the writings of Ignatius of Antioch that I have presented, there are several important themes that arise. But before we turn to those and to the other letters that he wrote, let me say a few words about Ignatius. He is clearly a bishop, the bishop of the church in Antioch. He dies probably during the reign of Trajan, around the year 107. We aren't certain about the circumstances of his death. He writes these letters en route to Rome while he is on his way to be executed. The circumstances of his arrest and condemnation are not specifically addressed in his letters, so we don't know whether it was a charge of local insurrection or because of the Neronian principle that Christianity is a proscribed religion. We don't know why he has been arrested and condemned. It's not likely that he is going to Rome to appeal his case as a Roman citizen, because throughout his letters he makes it clear that he already regards himself as condemned and he expects to die in the amphitheater, being torn to death by beasts, and that is how he's generally depicted in later Christian iconography. But we don't possess any tale or description of his martyrdom. The conviction that this is going to happen strongly suggests that the circumstances of his transportation to Rome are simply the necessity of providing condemned criminals for these spectacles. It's a reminder of the fact that for all of its wise laws and tremendous technological advancements, the Roman Empire was by our modern standards extremely bloodthirsty, and blood sport was extremely popular. Gladiators were too expensive to kill, and they generally did not die when they fought. Instead, the deaths that were seen and were desired in the public spectacles were those generally of criminals. And so there was a steady stream of criminals sent to Rome simply in order to be executed publicly, often in ways that would fascinate the public as a form of public entertainment. Ignatius is on his way to die, and en route, he writes letters to six different churches and to his friend Polycarp, whom we will see later when we look at Polycarp's own life and ministry. He writes to the churches in Ephesus, to the Magnesians, to the church of Tralles, to the church of Rome, to the church of Philadelphia, and to Smyrna on his way. And the selections that we will see are taken from his letters to the churches at Ephesus, the church to the Magnesians, to the Romans, and to the Smyrnians. The themes that will arise in these letters are fascinating. Remember, we're looking at the end of the first century. Ignatius is writing and representing a tradition that is still relatively contemporaneous with some of the older documents of the New Testament. This is extremely early information about the Christian church. And one of the most important themes we will see is that his understanding of and experience of ministry is not the same as we saw in Clement of Rome, who's just a little bit earlier. With Clement, you'll recall, we saw only the office of bishop, who was also called presbyter. There was not a distinction between the presbyters and the bishop. Episkopos, that means overseer or bishop, and presbyteroi or elders in Clement's letter are identical. It refers to the same group of people. It's the same title of honor. There is a separate office, as we saw in Clement, of deacons. So effectively, in Clement's earlier letter in Rome, we saw that there were two levels of, if you will, hierarchical ministry, two clerical orders, the presbyter bishop and the deacon. In Ignatius' letter, things are very different. Here we see the threefold ministry that still exists today in the Roman Catholic and Orthodox churches. Ignatius clearly distinguishes between the orders of deacons, presbyters, presbyteroi, which literally mean elders, and bishop or episkopos. The thing to bear in mind, as I think was mentioned in the letter on Clement, is that we must avoid translating the term presbyter, which literally means elder, as priest, because it is not really until the 4th century that this office, this middle rank of presbyters, will be accorded the title of priest. The Greek word hieros, which means priest, or sacerdos, priest in Latin, these are titles that generally refer to the bishop. in Ignatius' threefold ministry model rather than to the presbyters until, and it depends upon the region, but until about the 4th and then especially into the 5th centuries, when it becomes more common and regular for presbyters to be sent to as delegates by the bishop to preside at Eucharistic celebrations in smaller communities. But Ignatius is one who witnesses this threefold ministry. And for him, the office of bishop is very important. The office of bishop is central. For him, the bishop is the source of unity. The bishop is the one who presides at the altar, and indeed, his Eucharist is the only valid Eucharist. Where the bishop is, there the Eucharist can be. So he has a very strong sense of the episcopacy and of the role of the bishop. The presbyters, the elders, are his assistants. He doesn't describe the act of delegating responsibilities specifically to them, but he offers metaphors that imply a close working relationship and a mutually supportive approach between the multiple presbyters, the multiple elders, and the ranks of the deacons, and the single, what would come to be known as monarchical bishop in a given community. We saw in Clement a notion of apostolic succession, a very clear notion that the apostles had envisioned that they would die, and so they created their successors, the bishops, and in Clement's letters, the bishop presbyters. In Ignatius, this notion of apostolic succession is not as clearly described. He doesn't describe the origin specifically of the bishops as coming directly from the apostles. In later tradition, Ignatius' threefold ministry and Clement's idea of apostolic succession would be, as it were, fused and would be held together. But for Ignatius, the primary thing is not that the bishop is instituted by or represents the apostles, but in a very real sense, that the bishop represents Christ. He is the one who represents Christ in the local community. Several other themes that will arise in addition to the role of the bishop are what might be called a kind of proto-mysticism. In many ways, there is an ongoing discussion as to whether or not we can regard Ignatius as an early Christian mystic. Certainly some of the language that he uses of unity and union within the community and the idea of a union with God will be used in the later tradition in a very specifically mystical sense. He has a powerful and beautiful sense of Christ consecrating the baptismal water and thus making all water holy. He uses the word silence in a way that leads some authors to believe that he is speaking of the kind of silence in which one waits for God or listens for the voice of God, a kind of apophatic or imageless experience of the Lord. Some slightly more skeptical authors will say that no, when he talks about silence, he's primarily talking about the bishop's silence, and probably what he's doing in his letters is writing about bishops who don't preach well or who don't say very much, and that they are nonetheless to be respected even in their silence. There's a very strong Eucharistic element in Ignatius' writings. He clearly believes that the Eucharist is the body and blood of Christ. For him, it is the, as we will see, medicine of immortality. It's not just a participation in the sacrifice of Christ. It is, of course, the reception of Christ's own presence, but its effect is that we are united to Christ in such a way that death itself is overcome. And another very interesting aspect that remains somewhat controversial, as we shall see, is his apparent positive use of the term eros, or love. He says at one point, "My eros has been crucified," and that's been translated in a variety of ways, but Origen, the great 3rd century mystical theologian, believed, and many scholars today do believe, that Ignatius is using the language of eros, of erotic attraction, meaning deep passionate desire, as a way of describing his desire for God. So all of these elements have been viewed by many scholars as a kind of an early Christian mysticism. Others are somewhat more skeptical and offer other kinds of explanations for this language. In our next lecture, we will go over these texts in a little more detail and look at the various elements. But before we finish, let's look at the very beginning, the very start of this material, and If you drop down, the chapters are numbered, and you'll notice that we begin with a selection from the letter to the Ephesians. If you drop down, it's still in chapter 2, to the second paragraph of chapter 2, I have throughout this text some of my own comments. They're fairly obviously introduced, and they precede the texts. You'll notice that I have a section in which it's listed submission to the separate bishop and presbytery. Notice that the highlighted text there says that you are to be subject to the bishop and to the presbyters. These are separate institutions, separate ranks of the clergy, unlike in Clement, where they were the same. This submission is a means by which one is sanctified. Notice that in number 3, he says that the episcopal ministry is the will of Christ. Notice in the highlighted texts, even Jesus Christ is the will of the Father, and in that same way, bishops are so by the will of Jesus Christ. The implication is that as Jesus is obedient to the Father, so bishops are a kind of obedience to or represent a continuation of the presence of Christ himself. And then in number 4, he makes it very clear, a central notion, that the goal of the Christian in terms of inner relationship in the community should be to be in accord with your bishop. Your presbytery, he says, these elders who assist the bishop, are fitted exactly to the bishop as to the strings of a harp. Therefore, in your concord and harmonious love, Jesus Christ is sung. He uses musical metaphor, the metaphor of the choir, having one harmonious voice, to describe what it means to be in communion with one another under the direction of the bishop and the presbyters, and in a community where they are themselves working in accord. And this creates a harmony, and then if you drop down to the section just before chapter 5, a unity. Henotes, so that there is always a participation in God. There is a union among the members of the church that is itself a participation in God, a kind of a union with the Lord. And then in chapter 5, he says that, again, it's a kind of a reiteration, that you who are joined to your bishop, as the church is to Christ, and as Christ is to the Father, well, in this way, all things agree in a kind of symphony, in a kind of a union with various things with one another. So he likes this musical metaphor to describe what it is to be in relationship with one another as a community, and also to be in relationship with Christ. We will continue our discussion of Ignatius in our second lecture.